listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Charles Mann will tell you how his brilliant new book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created, actually originated with a question about an heirloom tomato plant developed in 19th century Ukraine, which he encountered in a school greenhouse. I'm going to actually let him tell you that story himself, but his story in his book will make you think in a new way about so many things, about food, about diseases, people, trade, and how events 4 centuries ago set a template for events we are living through today as the global network has become, as he says, the subject of a furious intellectual battle, and I don't think anyone here would disagree with that. Charles Mann is a great interdisciplinary thinker, scholar, and questioner. He synthesizes the latest research by ecologists, anthropologists, archaeologists, and historians to uncover the germ of today's fiercest political disputes, all the things that we are roiling and talking about, and you see in the op-ed pages, from immigration to trade policy to culture wars. And he always finds a great way to tell the story. And in his new book, you'll find him an authoritative and engaging guide from page 1 to page 410. You may already have read Charles Mann's other sweeping portrait of American history, The Mind-Rocking of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, which won the National Academy's Communication Award for Best Book of the Year. Or you may have read him in half a dozen magazines like The Atlantic, Science, or Wired, or even seen the 2 episodes he wrote of Law and Order. And in conversation with Charles C. Mann tonight, we have another great interdisciplinary thinker and writer, Richard Rodriguez. Richard is the author of an autobiographical trilogy that examines, respectively, class, ethnicity, and race in America. Richard's books are always close at hand on my bookshelves. I keep them right above my desk. We've missed him here at Aloud the last few years, and we were very lucky to coax him down from San Francisco, where he's hard at work finishing a book on the ecology of monotheism, the influence of the desert for the experience of God, for the Jew, the Christian, and the Muslim. I'm so pleased and honored to present these two writers in conversation with each other. Please join me in welcoming Charles C. Mann and Richard Rodriguez to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
First of all, let me just say how pleased I am to be here interviewing Charles. I feel a little bit like a child interviewing a giant. So if I seem a little starstruck, forgive me. I was reading your book over several days. My partner, Jim, and I tend to do a lot of reading on weekends, but in separate rooms. And if I'm making a lot of noise, laughter, if I slam a book down on the table, he'll ask, "What are you reading?" And on occasion, the occasion of this book, 1493, I would come into his room and he'd say, "What are you reading?" I'd say, "I'm reading this book about the tomato." "This most extraordinary book about a tomato, how it made its way up from South America to Mexico, and then it ended up on a plate of pasta in Italy." And then I'd go back to my room. Jim is under the impression that I'm growing, as I grow older, completely mad. But the book was mad, and it was not I that was mad. A few hours later, he said, "What are you reading now? Are you still on that book?" "I'm reading a book about malaria, about the relationship of malaria to slavery. I've never read this before. I've never heard such an idea." "Oh," he says, he's reading a book by an English novelist. The next day, Jim asks, "Are you going to read that book about malaria?" "Oh, I'm not into the malaria section at all now. Oh, I'm reading about Manila, about Chinatown in Manila. There was a Chinatown in the 17th century in Manila where you could get stir-fried chicken. And Jim says, oh. And then he said, as I finished this book, this remarkable book, what was it about finally? I said, I think the thing I will take always with me in the end is this story about an African in Florida, naked, whom the Indians see and confuse or maybe truly see as a spiritual and blessed man, and they give him gifts appropriate to his station. I've never heard of him before. To my surprise, reading this book, Charles, this book is about 5 centuries, not 1 year. 1493 seems a bit of a misnomer.
What's a sort of a stand-in?
Tell us a little about the ambition of this book and what you refer to as the Columbian Exchange.
The ambition of the book is really to find out why the tomato was growing in my garden. I mean, it's sort of the start.
That's how it starts, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you're a journalist, which is what I am, you get 2 kinds of stories. One is where the editor calls you up and says, would you do something about X or Y? And which I'm often happy to do. But my favorite kinds of things is when I notice something and I think, wait a minute. And so we lived in New York City for a long time and then moved out to the country because we wanted something a little bit more fast-paced. And, you know, I mean, the thing is about New York, you get in the subway and then for an hour, if you're lucky, absolutely nothing happens. Whereas in this little town that I'm in, you know, you pass through for 2 minutes and everything is there and it's gone. So we wanted something sort of zippy in that way. And so my son and I were trying to think of something to do, and some local college students we saw in our, you know, exciting small town paper had grown 100 varieties of tomatoes. I like tomatoes a lot. And so we thought, let's go to see it. And they had all these incredible, this was in the early 90s. I never heard of heirloom tomatoes. I never heard of all of that stuff that we now, I think probably most of you have heard of. And I looked, these are just great. And so they gave me this, it was sort of tomato pornography, this catalog of where you could get all these great tomato seeds. And I was reading it and I was thinking, these tomatoes aren't from around here at all. They're all Japanese or Ukrainian. I thought, yeah. And I just had this picture of all these tomato nerds, you know, like I kind of wanted to be, all over the world, you know, breeding and tasting their tomatoes. I thought, how weird that is, that this could have happened, because I had this idea that tomatoes came from Mexico. Actually, that's not true. They actually come from the Andes and then mysteriously came to Mexico.
Their taste was improved in Mexico.
Oh, they were toxic in the Andes. So why did they bring this toxic? You know, it's one of these historical yes. mysteries. And then I sort of started thinking, where do plants come from? I mean, you know, which somehow my elementary school teacher neglected to tell me. And I thought, I looked in my garden and absolutely everything I grew, I live in New England, wasn't from around there. And I realized that, you know, my garden, which I was sort of puttering around in and felt kind of homey and was actually this exotic, you know, cosmopolitan, modern, globalized object. It was like a completely weird artificial construct. And which was sort of strange to think as you're rooting around in there. And I thought, well, how did that happen? And in a large way, that was...
it would have been satisfactory to write a book called Tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Tomatoes I've loved. But this is only one chapter of this book about earthworms, about malaria. There is something in this book. It's almost as though you credit the events of 1492 with opening a door in the imagination of the world. And the 5 centuries after that you, I think the book ends in the 1990s, mm-hmm. The 5 centuries that you stride through engage questions of politics, slavery, colonialism, botany, biology, chemistry, history. At what point do you stop? I almost expected Tiger Woods to be in the end, that this golfer who calls himself a Cablanation
right.
is the end of the Columbian Exchange. What is the Columbian Exchange in your imagination? And how do you keep it all from falling off the book, the page of the book?
Well, I should explain this phrase, Columbian Exchange, and that's another starting point for the book. My family's from the Pacific Northwest, even though I live in Massachusetts now. And one of our great treats as kids was to go to Portland. And you know Powell's bookstore there?
Yeah, of course.
This unbelievable bookstore.
Still there.
It's still there. It's an amazing place. And so, you know, as a young adult, I still like to go there when I possibly could. And my wife was a little bit less enthusiastic about this because I would emerge with this huge box of books that we would then have to schlep around. And so I was sort of sent on with an allowance, you know. And so I was rummaging around the books, and I found this book with this title, Ecological Imperialism, which I thought, ecological, I mean, that's like two words that I had never imagined jammed together. And so I picked it up, and they have these awful rattly chairs that you can sit in for like 10 minutes maximum there. And I sat in there for about 2 hours, and I read about half the book. I thought, this is amazing. And what he was talking about was the fact that there's the Columbian Exchange, which is why this is not an irrelevant digression. What the idea is that when Columbus came, what he was doing was recreating the original. There, you know, 250 million years ago, there was a single giant continent. Scientists call it Pangaea. Geological forces broke it up, and as a result, there's completely different plants and animals over here than over there. And Columbus, in effect, recreates Pangaea. That's why it's important. And there's this ecological convulsion that happens. The world meeting itself. And this is why, actually, you should observe Columbus Day. I mean, it's a big deal in human history.
Yes. Birthday.
As opposed to celebrate, you know, enormous marker. It's the beginning of the modern world.
I always choose to celebrate it because I'm, as someone who is mestizo, part right. Spanish, part Indian, it's my birthday.
Yeah, and what's the birthday of everybody, really? Because you know, here I am. I'm a I'm descended from largely from Scottish people in this strange part of the world, married to a Japanese woman. I mean, it couldn't have happened all this without Columbus. Yes.
I'm going to say this publicly because I've been waiting to say it since I read your first book, or your other book, 1491, which was so, for me, so redemptive as a mestizo in America. I've never been able to accommodate my Spanish half to my Indian half. I could identify my Spanish half because the Spanish half spoke Spanish, was Roman Catholic, and so forth. But what was my Indian half, since I didn't speak the language of the Indian ancestors and so forth? What you have given me in 1491 is this idea that what the European discovered here was, in fact, that there was something here, that there were aqueducts, that there were dams, that there was a civilization here. And that it was not, as we've always portrayed it to be, a virgin land filled with people who were merely passive.
But who act like people nowhere else in the world, right? Everywhere, the way if there's a wilderness, because after all, the Americas have been occupied for 15,000 years, the implication is that these people lived here for thousands and thousands of years and didn't do anything.
That's right.
They're the most boring people
on
Earth.
That's right.
And the only people, I mean, it just doesn't fit. People are interesting. These are really dullards in this picture. And, of course, the instant you think about this, you say, well, that can't possibly be the case, that people just sat there and were like these Sierra Club tourists, sort of going, oh, look at the trees, look at the beach. I mean, that's not what people do.
Yes.
And so they built stuff. And
where did that idea come? I mean, I can think of any number of writers who speak of America, the United States, as having been virgin land, for example. Where does that idea come that the European came upon a place that was essentially empty?
Well, it's a really complicated question. So,
is that the arrogance of discovery?
No, well, it's part of that, I think. I mean, one has to, ethnocentrism, of course, is one has to play. Every group thinks it's really important, and the people that it's pushing aside are sort of not so important.
The Puritans required the assistance of the Indians to survive.
Well, that doesn't mean that people who aren't, all the Europeans who first came here required the Indians to survive. That doesn't mean that they can't think that they're not so important anyway, because it's sort of embarrassing. Right? But the real thing I think that happens is this wave of disease. One of the first parts of the Columbian Exchange is when these Europeans accidentally, inadvertently import all these diseases that existed in Europe and Asia and Africa and didn't exist over here.
Yeah.
And so between 1500 and 1650 or so, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters and or maybe perhaps even as much as 90% of the people in the Americas died. Yeah. And to me, this
That becomes a metaphor, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Where the European becomes the actor and the Indian becomes merely the victim of his action.
Well, in this one case, I think it's true. But the actual actor, of course, the Europeans don't understand. I mean, they don't have a germ theory of disease. The Indians don't have a germ theory of disease. For both of them, it's this unbelievable thing that happens. They don't understand why.
Yeah.
It has something to do with some, you know, celestial events, misfortune. They've been bad or good or what have
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
And so these extensively cleared areas that were throughout the Americas, where there's lots and lots of people living, lots and lots of farms, fill in with trees. And so by the time my ancestors came in the early 19th century,
farms are gone.
The farms are gone, and there's a forest. And they think, we always think that the world has been exactly like what we saw the first time.
Yes.
And
yes.
So that's part of it. And they it's hard to credit when you're in the 19th century coming here and seeing this forest that it was once completely different.
Yeah.
And
one of the wonderful things about Diego Rivera, who's quite mad, but on the murals in Mexico City, there will be these splendid murals of the
right.
of the dread conquistador, but usually with syphilis. and so while he may have raped the Indian, she brought him disease.
Right.
That what I took from your first book and what I take from this book too, is that the encounter between two human beings is going to change both of them.
Right.
And that seems to me so profound that we don't even recognize the importance of that today, that we really do imagine that, for example, that we can, this is not a political statement, we can trek through Iraq or Afghanistan, and that we will change them, but we will not be changed. In some way, this is the oldest expectation of the traveler, that they can look at the world and that the world will not, in some way, look back at them in such a way that they will be forever changed.
I think this is actually, maybe particularly for our culture that we have this, because one of the oddities of historiography is that if you read Mexican histories or histories in Brazil or Peru of the encounter, they recognize they create this mestizo culture, this culture that's a joint creation. And here the assumption is that they had no impact at all,
yeah.
Which, if you live in New York, as I did for a little while, how long did it take those Korean immigrants in Queens to start doing hip-hop moves? How long did it take, young black kids encountering those Korean kids to start doing kung fu? People learn from each other incredibly quickly. And so the assumption in our, often in our historiography here in North America that this encounter wasn't two-way seems to me, but it just seems puzzling to me. It just doesn't seem like how people really are.
Can I say that there is something in this book that is just so full of male energy? I think I mean...
Thank you, I think.
I didn't want to put it too near my bed at night. there is this testosterone in this book that is just filled with this male energy in the world just hacking its way through the forest. Brave.
Yeah. Brave and idiotic.
Yes, every adjective you want to give me is in these stories that you tell. The astonishing. I was in Alaska a few weeks ago, and I was asking a group of young men why so many in so many colleges now it's the young girls who are traveling, not the boys. I think in two out of three of the students who are traveling abroad as part of their college curriculum.
Really?
It's the girls. Yes. Okay. We're in the age of Ann Dunham, Barack Obama's mother, who went from Kansas to Hawaii to Indonesia, married twice and so forth. And the boys are upstairs playing video games. And I said to these boys, I said, what do you want from the video games? And they said, it's the only place where they can feel mythic. And I think to myself, these men that you are describing are mythic.
Right.
I mean, they must have been aware of their importance, of their self-importance that way, don't you think?
It's interesting, because I think it's true. There's a, I mean, one of the extraordinary things that happens after Cortez is suddenly all these Spaniards think, whoa, I can do this.
Yes.
You know, I can go out randomly and find gold.
Yes.
And they are able, it's a little bit like a dot-com boom.
Yes.
You know, when Netscape, you know, goes up, everybody's willing to fund the most idiotic ideas.
Yes.
And so random Spaniards can go and say, give me a boat, which is an expensive thing. Yeah, and they fly out in all directions.
One critic praised your book by calling it, referring to your prose as being very muscular. There is something in the prose that matches the audacity of the explorers that you were describing, insofar as there is some attempt to yoke the continents, and not simply across the Atlantic, but across the Pacific also. Yeah. Do you admire this habit within the male that you describe? Or
it's funny, I hadn't thought about it. I mean, I guess this is part of what people do, and of all cultures. You know, I describe how the Chinese are pushing out west and, you know, body slamming into Asian minorities.
Yep.
They're still doing this today.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's often when you read histories like this, there's a lot of hand-wringing. To me, it just isn't surprising that people do this. One of the most striking comments that is in the last book, I quote an anthropologist who says, Fran Kartunen, who says, if you read the Mexica accounts, the accounts of the people that Cortez conquered in the most brutal way possible, they, of course, don't want to be conquered. Of course, they bewail what happened, but they never blame the Spaniards. They think, this is what people do. And I think there's some truth in that. And in fact, if you want to stop people doing this, then the best way to do is accept that this is something that is, you know, not particularly to be assigned to one group or another. This is what people do.
Yes.
And so, you know, we have to, you can't just get too worked up about it. And there is, you know, these stories are extraordinary.
You come from I think your grandmother's great uncle,
mm-hmm.
Pittsburgh born.
Right.
Ends up in Brazil.
Yeah, a complete lunatic. Yeah, like these guys.
Yes, but it reminds me of a character in a Werner Herzog movie. One of these people that one would see in the jungle, you know, building a railroad.
Right.
This is
a railroad to nowhere.
With some admiration, you regard this memory.
He was tremendously brave. He wanted to encounter the world, but at the same time, he was obtuse and horrible. But you know, you can't let you have to see the person whole. These people are admirable in some ways, and I guess you have to think of them as one would want to be judged oneself. You know, certainly my own life isn't a perfect record of virtue.
Yeah.
But I would hope people would see me in the round and cut me a little bit of slack.
Yeah.
And
there are relatively few women in this book.
Well, unfortunately, that's the way it is. And some of the
But let me just ask that.
Named women. I mean, women are obviously
that's right. Named women,
but they don't make it into the
records. And the ones we expect, we find. Mm-hmm. Pocahontas, we find La Malinche.
Right.
I'm glad to find her because she was my great 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 grandmother in Mexico.
Literally?
She had to be.
But I'm actually, this is something I'm extremely proud of. That in the book, I do a pictorial representation of the family trees.
Yes.
Malinche is one of Cortez's many mistresses. And he had this incredibly convoluted family tree that, and he was actually also related to Pizarro, and they both married into the nobility of their respective places that they conquered. And one of the things that the Spaniards would do is, because they're just a few Spaniards, they would essentially, they couldn't really rule by force of arms, and so what they would do is marry into the native nobility, and thus essentially hijack the top. And then these empires would be continued to be
except
governed.
Except as you remark, their son,
right.
Martin,
right.
Goes back to Spain and becomes a member of the court in
right.
Spain. So that he, in a sense, hijacks them too.
Right. So people manipulate their status.
That's right.
Right.
What do you make of these stories, though, of these women in the New World,
mm-hmm.
like Pocahontas and La Malinche, who are able linguistically to talk to two societies and who have a flexibility of identity that one doesn't necessarily associate with the males of their tribe?
Well, I guess you know, this is, you know, really what this is about is people trying to make their way in the world. And there's it's a world for them that's in cataclysmic change. And there's a single constant in it. No matter what societies you go to, the women are second-class citizens, right?
Yep.
You know, it varies their degree in the way, but they're not usually prominent people in the society, not certainly as men. So they are simply making their way, and occasionally get to hear about a few of them, but they sort of pop up momentarily in the archives. But men do this too. I mean, men try to make their way, and you do have these people like my uncle, these sort of bull goose loonies who manage to go out into. But the great bulk of us are, you know, trying just to do what they can. And one of the things that is exciting in Spanish Latin America is that they have all these social castes that you can play off against each other and seize upon as identities. You talk about this in your own book, and. And you see this. I tried to tell as many. I love that stuff. The way that people would sort of say, "Oh, wait a minute, African slaves here. Africans don't have to pay taxes. I'm a small businessman. I'm African, right?" And they would claim the status here.
Yes,
or
yes, yes.
Indians get to do certain kinds of trade, long distance trade. Well, I'd really like to do that. So I'm an Indian.
Yes.
And then some Spanish family who they're related to will not have a proper heir, and they'll lose the estate if they don't have an heir. So they'll say, no, you're not Indian, you're Spaniard now. And so these incredibly fluid social categories that you're talking about. Well, I think that's very much the same as effort as what these people like La Malinche, who was a Maya woman. She wasn't Maya. She learned Maya,
that's
but
right.
She was actually from, she spoke Nahua originally, and was this was becoming sort of partly Spanish, was her third identity.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's some flexibility of selfhood, don't you think? I mean, I remember there was an essay by Joan Didion somewhere where she talks about her difficulty flying from New York to California, how long the 6-hour flight seemed.
Mm-hmm.
and then she remembered that her ancestors trekked across the Great Plains or something and died or didn't, by the time they reached the Rockies. And she wonders whether she has the capacity for that kind of physical bravery, but I would even argue for that kind of that flexibility of selfhood. Most of us are wedded to concepts of self that are really rather static rather than as fluid as you're suggesting that these Indian women.
But we're not in those situations. I mean, you know, who knows what would have happened, how we would be if we were in a world that was changing as rapidly as the world right after Columbus.
Yeah.
These are people, especially for native people, their entire village would have vanished overnight from disease.
Yes.
These strange, pasty-faced foreigners would have come in, would have come in, and then they bring in African slaves.
Yeah.
And then there's a Chinatown there. I mean, it's just
Charles,
it might seem rational for you to suddenly say, "You know, I think I'm just not going to be who I thought I was."
The most astonishing part of this book for me, since I don't like tomatoes as much as you do, is the business of the African.
Mm-hmm.
I have, I think in the mid 1980s, I began to hear from the U.S. Census Bureau the prediction that African Americans were about to be replaced. That was the verb that the Census Bureau used, replaced by Hispanics as the country's largest minority. There were so many things offensive about that prediction. One is that the notion that an African American would be replaced by me was not quite clear. But the notion that Hispanics are separable from Africans, when Africans were integral to the history of the Americas, that you have rescued this history is astonishing to me. And did it surprise you to come upon this history?
You sort of know that there's a slave trade, right? I mean, I think that.
We know the slave trade, but what the stories that you're telling is this: is not only the flexibility of self, but also the rebellion and the ability of slaves to survive as non-slaves.
Right, and that was in a sense, we all know that there was a slavery and that it was bad. I mean, I went to a terrible public school, but they managed to get and convey this to me. but then again, what I learned was that slaves are these passive victims. And they're dragged here, and they could do nothing. And then there's these abolitionists who are very noble types. And
Who freed them. Yeah.
And again, if you think about it, wait a minute, these people had no ability to do something for themselves, which people do stuff for themselves.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
If you think about it, this doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
And in fact, Africans are involved in all parts of the slave trade, in all kinds of roles, and that slavery leaked like a sieve. And many, many people left. And it makes sense, especially if you realize that a large fraction of the slaves who came in were prisoners of war. They were soldiers. Mm-hmm. African nations would be at war with each other, and they would sell the POWs. And so entire armies were sent over. And so the army of slaves was a slave army. And they, of course, they were military types. They escaped. They were especially in areas where there were kind of landscape was familiar to them. If you're from a tropical part of West Africa and you're sent to Brazil, this is a landscape you understand in a way that the Portuguese don't.
Yes.
And so it's highly possible for you to get out there. It's possible for you to establish independent communities that exist for hundreds of years. It's much more difficult up here because we're in the East Coast, you have winter, which is a much more potent way of keeping you in than any kind of English guy.
Charles, you're a historian, and you must answer this question for me, even if it's not a good answer.
Then you've given me license. This is the kind of thing.
How is it that we can lose hold of such a vast history? Is this a willful amnesia on the part of societies? How is it that we can stand it when we see these charts the American demographic charts where whites are here and Hispanics are here and blacks are here as though these are separate islands? How is it that we can forget so much about the history of the Americas?
I thought a lot about that. I'm really glad you allow me to give you a bad answer because it's a strange thing. You sort of know that there were a lot of slaves that came over to the Americas, but it's a shocking thing to realize that they outnumbered Europeans in the terms of the number of people who came over 3 or 4 to 1 until 1840. And so that all this stuff that we see from the colonial period, it was built by Africans. You know, these wonderful buildings, African hands built them, these colonial roads, African hands built them, these canals that were dug, Africans dug them. And then you think, well, wait a minute, the two majority populations here were African and Indian, with the Europeans as an important, but minor role in purely in demographic terms. And you think, well, how could that have been forgotten? And I think, when that a big part of that, this is just a guess, is that when there's a great wave of European immigration started by the Irish in the 1840s, and the big wave is, then later in the 1880s and 1890s, this big pulse of Europeans that come over, and for the first time, they become a really significant demographic presence in the boats that are coming over, and that's also the cessation of the slave trade. And they look around on these boats, right? And who do they see? People like themselves. And they land and they go into communities. And what are those communities? They're people like themselves. And you get this idea that this must be what's there.
It's almost too as though our grammar traps us after a while.
Yeah.
These words are not helpful. They separate us from our own reality.
Right. The reality was this place was a big jumble.
Yeah.
And has been for a really long time.
It is true in Latin America, if I say, soy indio.
Right.
That's unacceptable socially.
Well,
but if I say soy negro, that's equally unacceptable. So the whole language of blackness and Indianness becomes inadmissible in a kind of polite way, polite society.
But even though, at the same time, they know that you have this proud recognition in the textbooks in a place like Mexico that we're this fusion culture, this hybrid culture. But somehow, you have this scene that was so painful in your book where I had to kind of put it down where you say, that you're at the whitest dinner party you ever went
to
in Mexico City, and somebody says, "Well, we don't really have writers that look like you." I know exactly what you're talking about because people don't say that to me, but I hear when I'm over there the most astonishing comments.
Yes.
In that
this was
way.
A dinner party in Mexico City, an executive for Televisa, and they when a group of Mexicans of that class gets together. They talk about France, and he was talking to me about great hotels in France that he'd been in, And I was listening to all this. And in the middle of the conversation, he said, "Who are you?" he said. And I said, I'm a writer. I'm in Mexico City for a conference. He said, "You know, munching on his salmon," he said, "in Mexico, we don't have journalists who look like you," he said. Only Mexico would say such a thing to one of her children, you know. Yeah. But it's true that there is this vocabulary that it's just not sufficient to the reality that you're describing here. Speaking of, I think the African sections of this book are just dazzling, and that's what I will remember most from the book. But the Indian, there are these legends. You don't repeat it, and I'm not even sure that it's true now. Mm-hmm. The Taino Indian in 1492 seeing Columbus on the horizon, these ships, they come to the edge of the water to wait for Columbus. I've always thought in the Indian there is this absorbency in the presence of the foreign, almost Asian in that way, and that it meets the aggression of the European activist with this capacity to take the European in. The most interesting character in literature, Indian character, is Caliban in Shakespeare, mm-hmm. who wants to swallow this book,
right.
you know, and wants to devour Charles Mann, mm-hmm. and he will eat it. There is that sense of, I come to Los Angeles, and I look around, and everyone says, this is the great Hispanic city of America. And I think to myself, is that true, or are we in the great Indian city? And do we not have a word for that?
Right.
How do you see, in light of what you have written, how do you see a city like Los Angeles?
Let me go back to the Taino. Because to me, it isn't so much absorption, is that they come, they see this strange object, these ships, and then these tired, dirty people come on shore who smell bad.
Unprecedented people.
Yeah, unprecedented people who smell bad. And everybody's ethnocentric, right? So first thing they're thinking is, ugh, I'm sure, right? Just like, and these Spaniards, oblivious to how they smell, because after all, they've been there for a long time, you know, smelling each other, look around and they see these people dressed funny and they think, ugh. Right? This is the human part. And so the Indians look and they say, hey, these guys have some interesting stuff. I'll hold my nose and I'll see if I can acquire, you know, some of this stuff. A steel axe for people without steel is a big deal.
I want your horse.
And there's only a few of them.
Yeah.
There's only a few of them. So we'll give them some bad land, let them stay over there, we'll get their axes, and then when we have enough axes, we'll drive them out and kill them. And so it's a... And what they consistently make the mistake, because how can they know, is how many of those smelly people are over there and how willing they are to keep coming over. And
yet,
that's what happened in Jamestown. You know, they let them survive.
And yet eroticism exists within strangers.
Right.
People.
Well, that's a mass reaction, and then people get to know
that's
each
right.
other.
That's
and
right.
then they see each other as human beings.
And curiosity. You look different. You look different from me. Can I touch your hair?
Right. And they're always reporting that, you know, that the Indians are, you know, see these bristly beards and they want to touch them. They're sort of repelled and fascinated.
This notion that the Indians are prehistoric or anti-historical and that they belong in a reservation somewhere rather than in Los Angeles, that the person who comes to Los Angeles is therefore Hispanic, a child of Spain, not the Indian. Are we ever going to teach a generation of children to think of their Indian self as the actor, are we caught in this in this impossible history?
I don't know. It's because if you look at the historical records and you just read what's there, you know, the Maya, for example, there's zillions of Maya. I don't know how many million Maya there are still, and they were never conquered. I mean, when you go to Chiapas, I'll give you an example. In researching this book, I went to Chiapas. And I went to see Palenque, of course, which is this incredibly beautiful place. And my son and I are driving back on this road to San Cristobal. It's a terrible road with all those topes, you know, the speed bumps everywhere. And so we're completely not announced, and so you have to go 20 miles an hour because you're afraid to hit them. And suddenly, bing, out of nowhere comes a guy with a gun. And I think, right? And he looks at me and he says, who are you? And I say, look at us. And he just gets this look of terrible disgust on his face. He says, Norteamericanos, right?
And
that explains it.
And I say, and he goes, go on. I said, well, wait a minute. And he says, no, we want some Mexicans. Wow. And I'm in Mexico, right? But they don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm. I'm running out of time. I'm running out of time. I have to ask you about China, because there is China in this book, yeah. And there is Manila.
Mm-hmm.
And the China that you, I was reading them in the Wall Street Journal recently, a book review, that concluded by saying that there are two things Americans are afraid of, China and their children. but this, the China that you portray in the 17th and 18th century seems more like today's China than not. These are not people who are held by their own wall. These are people who are trespassing into the world,
right,
and who are engaged in the commerce of the world in the most astonishing way. Do you see China as a continuous intervention within this Colombian experiment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's important to realize that the big event, and the event that, the other event that I guess after the diseases that I think should be taught in the schools, is that what the most important event from the European point of view, and then with the world point of view, is that in 1545, the Spaniards discover this huge mountain of silver.
Yes.
In Bolivia, in Potosi, in this amazing town that they created around it. It's, the for a while, the biggest town in the Americas.
Yes. 13,000 and one of the biggest towns in the world, you see.
Right. Yes. It's this extraordinary, crazy boom town,
yep.
Which I had a really lot of fun reading about, because it's like, you know, Dodge City, except with all these different crazy people and a much larger scale.
Yeah.
And it lasts for a couple hundred years, and just an incredible amount of silver comes out of it, mined by countless Indian and African slaves. This river of silver pours out and goes across the world. And, an extremely large fraction of it, and scholars argue about how much it is, half, two-thirds, ends up in China. And there's this connection, right, around the world now, where American silver, mined by Africans, is taken by Europeans to China in return for silk and porcelain that is then shipped across Mexico to Spain.
Yes, yes.
And the money from that is then taken to buy Africans to need, you know, there's this...
Yes.
There's this pulse that is created by this wash of silver. And
I'm gonna ask you, just on that sentence,
mm-hmm.
the hardest question and the last question, and that is this reunion of the world, the mm-hmm. world meaning itself after the fracture of 12 million years ago, this encounter, you know, when I see friends who are paying $500 to get their DNA examined, is that what we really want to find out is what we don't know about the line, mm-hmm. what our grandmothers didn't tell us.
And there's a lot of us who are...
Yes, I know there are a lot of us. There are a lot of family secrets. But do you feel this story comes... You are such a wonderful storyteller, and the joy of this book is unending, but there is a great deal of calamity in this book. Mm-hmm. There are deaths and disease.
But that's the human... And, sorry.
Do you feel... the question, I guess, is not would we be better not to have met each other,
mm-hmm.
since that's impossible, but are you optimistic about this thing that's going to continue? This 1493 is not over.
Mm-mm.
It continues. And when I said Tiger Woods, I meant that jokingly, but in some way, we're playing out the dramas of 1493 in the city.
Right.
And the concerns with illegal immigration.
The whole country, that's right. Yeah.
Are you optimistic?
Well, I think the way I hear your question, you're saying, is the pains of this kind of calamitous, explosive mixing that's been going on for 500 years outweighed by the gains?
That's right. Or do we as human beings somehow manage to find some benefit in this calamity?
I guess for me, when I think about this and wrestle with it, is that the problem is the pains and the gains, the goods and the bads are incommensurate. Let me give you an example. The potato comes to Europe. The sweet potato comes to China. Millions upon millions of people are kept from premature death because of this. It's an extraordinary boon to humankind that China, you know, is no longer racked by famine. Europe is no longer racked by famine. This is a good thing, I think, right? Children are no longer dying. But that same tidal wave of globalization is sweeping away languages and cultures at this extraordinary rate. And you always hear, if you go to, you know, your part of the world near, near Silicon Valley, you know, about the information explosion, how much more we know. But you want to say, wait a minute, are we losing a language every 10 days or whatever the guess is? So that there's this huge human cost to this.
Do you fight it?
Hmm?
Do you fight it? Do you become the last
person? Or do one?
No, does one, as a human response, does one try to fight this global energy, or has the door now been open and it can't close?
I don't think the door can close, but you can certainly, on a human level, mitigate this. And I think people are torn. You know, they want to embrace the world. You want to, my kids, are tremendous fans of Japanese anime, and they have a little manga fan club, there in Amherst, Massachusetts, right?
Yeah.
Which is, and so that's a fine thing, right? They're exposed to but at the same time, there's all kinds of other reasons why they want to kind of cling. I and my wife want to cling to our little New England-y, and we're torn in this way. And I think that's an essential contradiction that we have to live with.
So that ambivalence is just a modern condition.
Yeah, I think that's home.
I'm going to ask you to read something from your book, just because I want the audience to have a sense of the texture of your prose. It's one of the most delightful things about his prose is that a man this smart does not, one, he can write, but two, he can tell wonderful stories. And it's the discovery of the book, that is, this story about discovery and exploration, becomes your story too. And that many times in the course of these chapters, you are in China or you are in Bolivia, you're discovering things and asking questions of people. And it's really quite a wonderful, I don't want to say parody, but an imitation of the best of this, of the traveler's tale, to do the same thing. Could I ask you to read something about maybe your grandmother's uncle?
Okay. This was a true discovery. Reading about the Amazon in about the 19th century, and there's this huge rubber boom then where all kinds of people went out into the Amazon, often with huge numbers of enslaved Indians, and took rubber from the rubber trees. And rubber is an essential part of the Industrial Revolution. You can't have engines without belts and gaskets and O-rings and all this stuff. And the best supply came from the Amazon. And so I'm reading these accounts, and people keep referring to this book by this guy, Neville B. Craig. And which the thing that's really strange is that in my living room is a picture of an ancestor of mine, Neville Burgoyne Craig. And after a while, I think, what are the odds that this would be this guy? And I find it is. This guy in the living room is played as a part in this story that I read. And so I had this sort of genealogical kick to the thing, and I started researching about I've always thought we came from a family of lunatics, and here's another prime example. So in my living room hangs a portrait of either my grandmother's uncle or a great-great-uncle. Both men were named Neville Burgoyne Craig. My grandfather, who found the painting in a thrift shop, thought that the subject was the older Craig, the founding editor of the first daily newspaper in Pittsburgh. But the late 19th century style of the painting suggested it was the younger Craig, an engineer who took ship for the Amazon a week after his 31st birthday. He intended to make his fortune in rubber. Craig was not planning to work directly with rubber. Instead, he intended to help build a railroad to transport it. Then, as now, the primary source of natural rubber was latex from Hevea brasiliensis, which is the tree. Native to the Amazon basin, the tree is most abundant on the borderlands between Brazil and Bolivia. The ports nearest to this area are on the Pacific coast, across the Andes. Sending rubber to those ports would mean carrying it across the high, icy mountains. After doing that, shipping the latex to England would involve dispatching ships around the stormy southern tip of South America, a long and dangerous trip of almost 12,000 miles. The entire route was so difficult, in fact, that the secretary of the Royal Geographical Society calculated in 1871 that it would be four times faster to ship rubber to London from the western Amazon by transporting it down the Madeira River to the Amazon itself and then to the Atlantic. The problem was that waterfalls and violent rapids blocked a 229-mile section of the lower Madeira. West of the stretch were 300,000 miles of navigable river in Bolivia and vast supplies of rubber. East of it was the wide Amazon and then the Atlantic. The downstream end of the impassable stretch was the Brazilian hamlet of Santo Antonio. My ancestor went to Santo Antonio to build a railroad around the rapids. Born in Pittsburgh, Craig took his undergraduate and engineering degrees at Yale. He was a fine student who won 2 university mathematics prizes and was hired by the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey before graduation. 5 years later, seeking excitement, he joined P&T Collins, a Philadelphia railway construction firm, which had obtained the contract to build the Madera Railroad. The two Collins brothers seem to have believed that their considerable experience with railroads trumped their utter lack of experience with the Amazon. In January 1878, they sent out 2 shiploads of eager volunteers, engineers, and laborers from Philadelphia. Craig went in the first vessel. As he later recounted in a memoir, winter gales plagued the journey to the Amazonia. The storms wrecked the second and, alas, much less seaworthy ship about 100 miles south of Jamestown, Virginia. More than 80 people drowned. Company officials had trouble replacing the lost men. Philadelphians, shocked by the disaster, had lost their enthusiasm for the venture. Eventually, Collins hired a new workforce from the, quote, slums of several of our large eastern cities, to quote Craig's book, people, quote, exhibiting in shape, countenance, and gesture striking evidence of the soundness of Darwin's theory. Most were immigrants from southern Italy. Many have been pushed out of their homes for their anarchist beliefs. As my ancestor's snarky put-down suggests, anti-Italian prejudice was then widespread. These newly arrived Americans, in consequence, were desperate for work. The Collins brothers took advantage of their desperation to sign them up for lower wages than they paid the laborers on the first ship. Apparently, it did not occur to the brothers that the anarchists would discover this arrangement or that they would find it unacceptable. Meanwhile, Craig steamed up the Amazon and the Madeira to the proposed railway terminus at Santo Antonio and set to work surveying the route. He learned of the fate of the men on the second ship only when the Italians arrived as replacements. At the same time, the Italians found out that they were being paid less than everyone else. Within days, they went on strike. The engineers, Craig among them, constructed a cage from the steel rails for the railway and forced the strikers into it at gunpoint. Reading the memoir, I waited in vain for any recognition from Craig that imprisoning the workforce could have a negative impact on the construction schedule. Ultimately, the strikers went to work, sullenly hacking at the forest. A few weeks later, quote, 75 or more took off for Bolivia. None made it, perhaps, Craig luridly speculated, because they had, quote, served as food to gratify the none-too-dainty appetites of the anthropophagous Parentintins. That's anthropophagous is a fancy way of saying cannibalistic. The Parentintins, a nearby native group, had kept potential colonists at bay by cultivating a reputation for ferocity. In one way, the workers' flight may have been a boon. The expedition was running out of food. Like the Jamestown colonists, I talk about this earlier in the book, my ancestors' party was starving in the midst of plenty. Agricultural geneticists have long argued that the area around the railroad route, the Brazil-Bolivia border, was the development ground for peanuts, Brazilian bar beans, and 2 species of chili pepper. But in recent years, evidence has accumulated the area was also the domestication site of tobacco, chocolate, peach palm, a major Amazonian tree crop, and most important, the worldwide staple, manioc. My ancestor nearly died from lack of food in one of the world's agricultural heartlands.
I remember once talking to Bill Clinton, and he told me that he was 1/20th American Indian. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if Bill Clinton could come upon that Indian somewhere in the jungle who sounds like him and who carries on the way he does. But to come upon your great-great-great uncle in the Brazilian jungle is part of this American story, it seems to me, that we are wedded to this history. And the shock is that we have forgotten so much of it and that so much of it has been withheld in our families.
So interesting what went on. It's unbelievably interesting when I think about what we were actually told. No wonder the history seems boring.
Yep.
I mean, but
Let me open this up to questions from the audience because I've had too much of you for too long.
That's actually could be taken several ways, couldn't it?
Yeah, my name is Mario, and I have a question. Why isn't this history taught in our schools? Yeah.
Do you know how textbooks are written, are produced in this country? Okay, the way it's been explained to me, I'm not or a textbook writer, but the way it's explained to me is that if you're a textbook company, you want to produce a textbook that will be sold and read throughout the United States because they're very expensive things to produce and you have to recoup your costs by having lots and lots of students read them. And a number of states have special agencies that have to approve the textbooks, is so has been explained to me. And the way one publisher put it to me from Random House is that, the three most important states in this are New York, Texas, and California. And the way he explained it to me is that if you can't sell your textbook in New York, Texas, and California, you can't. You basically, it's worthless. But the problem is that the New York board is super liberal, the Texas board is super conservative, and the California board is super crazy. And I don't actually have any personal experience with this. I'm just telling what you said. And so once they kind of thread the needle through this, they're really reluctant to change it because if they change the textbooks too much to accommodate, recent knowledge, then they have to go back through this. And almost all of this will offend somebody. Yeah.
There's something else, too, and you're being too generous. We're right now in Hispanic History Month or something like that. And, you would think that some of this African story would be part of our history. And I've always said that if you want to do a real Hispanic History Month, you should have the Irish coming through here, because the Irish, the San Patricios, for example, a story that's almost unknown in America, even to the American Irish, the defection of American Irish immigrants to the Mexican side of the Mexican-American War. It's an extraordinary story, well known in Mexico, but nowhere told in this. We almost can't bear a history that starts overlapping. What is the Irishman doing in this story about Mexico?
Right. Well, you see it yourself. We have Hispanic History Month, and so everything about all of this stuff gets, there's 30 days, and that's when we learn about it, and it doesn't have anything to do with the other 11 months.
Yeah,
and we have Black History Month, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the other 10 months are for Europeans.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, I wish we could, but in fact, the other 10 months are vacuous. So.
Has writing this book ruined gardening for you, or can you still go out and garden, or do you see the world differently now?
I still like to garden. It's very helpful. I'm not a very good gardener. I have these friends who are really good gardeners, and they sort of sneer at my thing. But I'm a writer, so I'm not expected to be very good at very much. But the answer is no, because if the more you know about something, for me, often the more you appreciate it. And when I look at these spindly tomatoes that I've got because I've failed to water them, I'm just marvel at the journey they've made to me. And that when I do my incompetent seed saving and hoping that they will grow for the next year, you realize you're part of this crazy tradition. And when I take them to my friends in Seattle and give them for their gardens, you realize what a part of a huge tradition you are. And that it's also, in a certain way, in the larger, it's I think, easier to feel a little bit relaxed about what's going on in the world if you say, wait a minute, this is part of something that's been going on for a long time. And it doesn't mean it's not super important. It doesn't mean it's not super serious. But it's not this sudden onslaught that's happening to us right now. It's part of a long process that maybe we can intervene in a way and change it for a common good. At least that's how I feel. But of course, I might be totally delusional.
Hi. Do you know what Cristobal Columbus actually did to the Spanish monarchy? Because there is very few Columbus statue in Spain. And he's not honored as it is honored in the rest of the world.
He's a kind of equivocal figure. He didn't, after all, set out to discover. He didn't set out to do what he did. He never really copped to the fact that he hadn't landed in Asia. And the Spanish monarchy foolishly gave him all these privileges that they then took away from him. So he died a very bitter guy, who was widely reviled in that area. So it's, you know, it's not surprising to me that that after all they have this ambivalent reaction to him. I think that that feeling is also more general than not. I mean, if you go to Santo Domingo, there's this enormous monument, right? There's this huge, huge monument to him. It's like this cross-shaped thing. It's, I don't know, 600 feet long or something, and that has all these lights that shine up. That's so intense, actually, when they shine it, it supposedly blacks out all the areas around it. And there are huge protests when they put it up. So I'm not sure that he's so honored elsewhere in the world. He's a profoundly important guy, but not people feel a little unease about him.
There's a lot of movement these days with some purists to get back to and protect what they call the natural species in an area, or the native plants, for example, or the native animals. I'm just wondering, do you think that's an exercise in futility, and even whether it's good or not good?
Well, I think it's... sometimes there's invasive species, exotic species that come in and are clearly, you know, bad. In my area in New England, for example, you know, Dutch elm disease came in and wiped out the elms, or chestnut blight. And these are exotics that come in and clearly cause tremendous damage. And so any rational person, I think, would be want to protect their ecosystems against this kind of invader. But, you know, the tomato is an exotic, right? The ones my area, we're very proud of our asparagus. We live in the Asparagus Valley. And believe it or not, there are little signs. But it's an invasive, you know, it's an exotic species, not invasive, but it's an exotic species. And so on some level, it seems foolish, you know, for us to celebrate and consume and depend on these exotics, and another level to frown on them. But at the same time, we're building a house, and kind of for fun, we're trying to, you know, decorate our garden entirely with New England species, you know, the ones that we aren't growing to eat, and we're having a lot of fun with it, you know, going out and picking out these plants we don't know very much about, and ordering them and so forth. So I see no harm in it as long as you don't take it too seriously.
So when I found 1491. In a airport bookstore, mm-hmm. and picked it up and read it. It opened up my eyes to something I hadn't read before, which I think why you made the comment about why our textbooks mm-hmm. don't teach us that. And as you're talking tonight, I'm drawn to the writing of other authors that I've read, Jared Diamond, mm-hmm. for example, in Guns, Germs, and Steel, or Eduardo Galeano, for mm-hmm. example, from lots of years I lived in Latin America. Is there a community of writers that you feel a part of, or other people you can mention who are writing about these things in ways that perhaps weren't revealed to us by other writers in the past?
Well, my book, I say in that there's a book called The Columbian Exchange. It was published 30 years ago, and I say, I hope I acknowledge it enough. It's a wonderful book, still in print. It's really worth reading. It's by Alfred Crosby. And I say, I think in the acknowledgments that my book is scribbled in the margins of his book. He also wrote this book, Ecological Imperialism. So those are two tremendous books. There's, if you're interested in, you know, the Spanish conquest, there's a whole series of books by John Heming about Spanish and Portuguese conquests that are just absolutely fabulous. So there's a long list of people who have written great stuff about this. If you're interested in sort of ideas about how to think about these things. There's this guy, Rodriguez, who's written some really excellent stuff. So I try in the books to sort of tip my hat to the stuff that I think is really good, and there's a little bibliographic type essay at the back where I sort of wave my stuff.
Charles, it does seem to me also that history often has examples of this exchange of identities, mm-hmm. where you end up tending your tomatoes, mm-hmm. when some Indian tribe in upstate New York is opening a casino,
right,
and chopping the forest down, that there is this wonderful wisdom that passes. It's my turn to so to ransack the environment for a time.
Okay.
You can plant you can plant the tomatoes. Don't you think that sometimes that, you know, I think of the conversion of Latin America to Christianity by the Spaniards. It depleted Europe in some way. You go to the churches of Europe and they're all empty.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Latin America and the churches are all full, and the evangelical Protestantism is spreading throughout the Brazil and Central America. Catholicism is still full in Mexico and in the villages of South America. The Mormon Church now, in its world majority, its world population, is Spanish speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that somehow I have swallowed something of you, mm-hmm. and that I have become the brutalist in nature, while you have become me.
Right?
Do you think that's possible?
Sure, but also, I mean, it's important to remember that native societies, again, aren't these tree
huggers,
right?
They're not Johnny Appleseed.
Right. They certainly had the kind of agriculture they practice. There's certainly things that we can learn from, and in fact, agronomists are studying them to this. But and when we talk about the casinos and so forth, you know, it's important to remember that this is actual federal policy.
Yes.
You know, we passed the Indian Gaming Act in 1878 with the idea that these guys were going to do
it. Yes.
And so it's always amazing to me, you know, I'm in a state that doesn't have any of this. So, you know, we have this sort of lofty perspective, right? and I think, like, wow, the whole purpose of this was to give Indians money. And here in California, then it becomes this huge issue. All these Indians have money. And which is not taken as a success.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
But a decadence. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you think about 1421. You know, about the Chinese. They,
right.
you know, they were there 70 years before Columbus.
Well, the book, you mean?
Yeah.
This is a book. I should probably explain a little bit. There is an amazing Chinese explorer named Zheng He, a Muslim eunuch who led these huge, seven huge armadas, one of them maybe the largest ever, 300-some ships, from southeast China and then across the Indian Ocean, and just sort of throw China's weight around and scared the pants off of everybody he visited with this enormous flotilla. And they know that they went all the way to the southern part of Africa, and this book, which is by this retired submarine captain named Gavin Menzies, says that the fleet split up and they went to the United States and to the Caribbean and Europe and went basically around the world, and as a big part of it, they landed in the Americas before Columbus, and I should say that the great bulk of I've never encountered a historian who believes this, so it's a distinctly a minority viewpoint, and I actually very much enjoyed the book, but I have a terrible weakness for nautical stuff, you know, and he's a retired submarine captain. It's full of I matey, you know, type. There's like poop decks in it, and so I'm just a total sucker for this kind of stuff, and so I read it with great pleasure. At one point, he says that the proof that they actually discharged a whole bunch of Chinese in Buzzard's Bay, which is where between Rhode Island and Massachusetts there's this bay, Newport's near there, was that when Verrazzano, who was the first European to go by there in the 1520s, he landed at Buzzard's Bay, and he noted that the women there were much better looking than all the other women. And so Gavin Menzies says, see, Chinese. And there must have been Asian. And my wife, who's Japanese, finds this completely convincing. And, of course, I better as well. but, you know, all I can say is that I wish it were true, because I think the world would be much more interesting if it were. But I don't think that he's really built up a case that really grabs me. And I would encourage you to read it because it's really fun to read.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm interested in this idea of encountering difference. There's so many instances of these encounters being fraught with violence, right? And I'm wondering how we can encounter difference when even things like our language, our worldviews, our frameworks don't allow for us to understand or approach this difference from a place of humility. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, actually, I think people are, you know, sort of overall getting a little better at this. I mean, the encounters that were between the Spaniards and Native people, or between the Chinese and the Native people in the Philippines or the West, are, you know, sort of comically awful. You know, just, and you know, you just don't read about that kind of, you know, just absurd catastrophe, which you see again and again and again throughout the world when one person encountered each other in the 15th or 16th century. I think we have a long ways to go, but you know, one of the sort of weird comforts of researching this book is, for instance, Balboa comes and meets a group of people he's never encountered before in Panama, and apparently there's a bunch of guys there who are wearing skirt-like clothes, and there seems to be some sort of power struggle going on between in this group of Native people, and they see these Spaniards there, and they say, "Those people, see them in skirts? They're all homosexuals." It was just apparently elite clothing, and so the Spaniards then set dogs on them and kill them all. And I was reading this, and I think, you know, I don't think this would happen now. You know, that they wouldn't, the people just wouldn't be so naive, and immediately think, "Oh, I will go kill these people." And so that, I guess I actually come to it from a different point of view. It was so bad then that we actually look a little bit better now. I don't know if that's cold comfort, maybe.
Can I add, too, that I think that there's some duality of energies going on right now, that at the same time, I mean, I don't want to be a Mexican nativist because Mexico doesn't interest me that much, finally, but at the same time that America is so repulsed by Mexico and wanting walls and so forth, and so that this appetite for Mexican food is happening at the same time. Marco Polo would tell you that before people speak to each other, they eat each other. and that there's some energy right now, even in the miscegenation that we are arranging on our plates, you know, this kind of Thai, Finnish food, that suggests that we have an appetite, a literal appetite, to devour the world. And it at the same time that, you know, over dinner, we carry on with these announcements of Armageddon.
But, and don't you see that to me the fence, I mean, obviously there's a real problem of illegal immigration, and you know, much of it having to do with idiotic policies by the Mexican government to dispossess, effectively dispossess people especially in the southern part of Mexico, and the U.S.'s function for decades is a kind of safety valve for them, and so clearly there's an issue there. But at the same time, you know, when you look at these efforts that have taken place in Latin America, you know, for centuries, one group of people trying to shut the door on another group of people, it's almost always a sign that the battle's over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's my job to end the evening, but to remind you, this sounds like something on PBS, but to remind you that we are living in this in this temple of the book, and that we forget that the weight in one's hand has a special power that the Kindle doesn't quite capture. having spent some time in the Middle East recently, and watching Jews and Muslims and Christians hold their holy book and kiss it, I've never been to a bar mitzvah where anybody walks in with a Kindle over their head. Remember that, and respect this building for these books, and this man for having produced this magnificent book. Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.